to the Forest School Podcast with Lewis Ames and Gemma Sutherland.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, you've moved your butt now.
I've moved further away because
you're
going
to be further away boomier. From the microphone.
No, that's fine.
Okay. Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Hello. It's my podcast host voice.
Yeah.
Welcome to the BBC. BBC Outdoors.
I don't think we can say that.
Why? Oh, no, we can't. Okay. Hi. Anyway, this is a podcast we recorded a couple of weeks ago. We're very lucky to speak to Maya Rose Craig, also known as Bird Girl. She's awesome. She gave us half an hour of her time. And we spoke about birding and activism and...
Access to the outdoors.
Access to the outdoors.
All kinds of things. And it was great to get a... I think the term is youth voice.
Youth voice, exactly.
Because we are old people.
Old and cranky. So, here's a podcast with her, and then we're going to release another podcast now, same day. So after you've listened to this one, you can listen to us waffling on about things that she's kind of...
What a marathon.
You know.
A marathon. You can have two podcasts in a day.
Podcast two for the price of one.
Guys.
So, you know, she made us think about some birdie stuff, didn't she? So we're going to be speaking about some birdie things and talking about a couple of books we've read after as well. So,
cool.
Enjoy.
Yeah, so Mike, you've been really busy over the last few months doing lots of things, but birding, let's start with that. So you're the youngest person to have seen over half the world's birds, is that right?
Yeah, that happened last summer. That was really exciting, actually.
The bird that took you past that point?
Well, that's a funny one, because the way that listing works mean that sort of the number of birds that you've seen is constantly shifting, because they're always adding in new species or taking away new species when they find out more and more with science. And because there's so many, it's shifting around quite a lot. So the bird that got me over half of the world's birds is no longer the bird that got me to half the world's birds. And at the moment it's actually a harpy eagle, which is really exciting because, that's literally one of my favourite birds ever. And it was something I was trying to see for about 9 years before I finally managed to track one down. And they're amazing. They're like they're the biggest eagles in the world. And they have these massive claws and they live in the Amazon. And they're just, they're just gorgeous.
Wow. So you were in the Amazon. Were you there with your family?
Yeah. We went to Brazil for 5 weeks last summer.
Amazing. And your parents are both birders too, I understand.
They're both avid bird watchers.
Wow.
Is why we do these family trips away together each summer.
Nice. And you got started at a really young age, just out with them, and it was something that kind of caught your imagination as well?
Definitely. I mean, I've literally been going bird watching since I was a baby. My parents took me for bird watching for the first time when I was 9 days old. And my mum was also very intensely birding while she was pregnant with me. So I guess it's in the blood. I like to joke that I didn't really have a choice or I would have been like booted out of the family. I've always loved birding and there's always been something about it that's really captured my imagination. It's great. I love that.
Yeah. What were the birds that you remember really loving when you were little?
There's all sorts. I think when I was really little, it was a lot of those like really traditional like English garden birds that really did it for me. So I really loved the wrens and the dunnocks and the robins and that sort of thing. And I still do, actually. I'm very fond of those sort of little brown birds that are so typical in England, even though I know a lot of people find them quite boring. But I think, because when I was 6 going on 7, my family and I did something called a big year, which is basically trying to see as many birds as possible in a year in the country. And we don't do anything by half measure. We were very intense. We were out every weekend and then a bit more. And my favorite bird that I saw that year was a black-browed albatross. Which was really exciting. You don't get them in the UK very often at all. And it was when we'd been sat on the coast for hours waiting for something really exciting to blow in on the wind. And eventually this albatross did. And it just started sort of circling around near the cliffs, near the rocks. That was incredibly exciting.
Wow. Whereabouts was that?
That was down in Cornwall, actually. Oh,
cool. What's that? It's a vulture that's been seen in the UK this summer. What's that all about? Tell me about that.
There's been a lammergeier hanging around basically in the Peak District in the UK, which has been very exciting because you don't get many of them at all here. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I haven't actually been able to go up and see it. I feel like I'm the only bird in the UK who hasn't. It's just been really exciting. And it's been slightly dubious about whether or not people can add it to their list because there's very strict rules around it being like a self-sufficient population and stuff. It means that if they've been introduced, they have to have been there for, I think, three generations without human interference.
You can't just walk around the zoo ticking stuff off. Yeah.
exactly. And the problem is they've been introducing lammergeiers into I think it's the Pyrenees, which is where they think this one has flown from. But there's also some independent populations nearby that they introduced in like the 80s that have been there for long enough to be self-sufficient. So at the moment, they're trying to do some detective work to find out if it's one of these introduced birds or not. Mm-hmm. And everyone's like hanging by to find out whether or not they can count it on their list.
Right. I saw a little egret in the river near me recently, and I was really excited because I've never seen one before. And I told my dad, who's much more into birding than me, and he was like, oh, yeah, they're really common. And then I Googled it because I was like, I'm not sure they're really common, Dad. I'm sure I've seen a really important bird here. And it was saying how actually they were reintroduced, having been made extinct because people wanted the plumage on the back of their head for millinery in Victorian times, which is like a cool little fact in itself. But they've only been sort of successful over the last few decades. And for me, that was still quite exciting, even though it's been reintroduced, the fact that it's, you know, it's successful and breeding and moving around the UK in quite a short space of time. I was like, oh, that's really cool. I don't really see that as a, you know, a less exciting discovery, if you know what I mean. Just going back to, you were talking about the little brown jobs that lots of us find difficult to distinguish between in the garden and stuff. So we're forest school practitioners, and for us, those are going to be the first kind of birds that either we see with our groups or that children that come or learners that come and visit us are familiar with. Would you say, if you were kind of talking to a young person who was beginning in birding, is there anything you kind of advise them to kind of watch for when observing garden birds, or anything like way in that would perhaps spark somebody's imagination, what to look for or when to look?
Yeah, definitely. I think something that's always very fun, especially if you have like a feed route or something, so there's going to be something that's encouraging all these birds to come in, is literally just like sitting down and watching them and watching all their behaviours and stuff. And I think especially robins always do it for a lot of people because they're very... Well, we interpret it as them being very friendly because they're willing to like sort of come up close and say hello. But for them, they're being very aggressive and protecting their territory from us and stuff. Yeah, robins are notoriously really aggressive. But it means that they're very out and about and you really can just watch them and observe them. But I think also just... I think games and competitions always interest a lot of people. So in the past... we've done a lot of, just making things into competitions, like who can identify the most birds, who can find the rarest bird in the garden, but also doing like bio blitzes with teams and stuff, which is basically trying to find as many different species of animals and insects and plants as possible in your little green space. And I think, you know, just really having something to work towards can get kids to really muck in and get their hands dirty, I suppose.
Yeah, that's great advice. We were talking the other day in another podcast about how sort of being on one patch and knowing one patch really well, so your local park or woodland or public space, and visiting that regularly, like throughout the seasons. That's been really helpful for me in terms of learning bird songs and call. And that probably, yeah, this will be my fourth or fifth year working in one woodland with Lewis. And I feel like I've now got down quite a good number of sort of springtime bird song. But I've just realised recently that it's only really springtime that I've got nailed. I haven't really necessarily got like this time of year when things maybe are getting a little bit quieter. Is that right in terms of things you're going to hear? Is that something that you've done and visited like your local patch quite regularly as well as jetting off all around the world?
Yeah, of course. I'm a big fan of local birding. And you're right about it getting a lot more quiet this time of year. As to be honest, most of the adult birds especially are just recuperating from looking after their chicks for months and months. And I think actually my favourite area during lockdown, where I've just been able to spend loads of time just watching, has just been my garden, because I'm really lucky. I live in the countryside. I have a lovely garden that we've like made into a proper wildlife friendly space with a long grass and a pond and all that sort of thing, and loads and loads of bird feeders, of course. And I think really just watching things as the months have gone by and the different behaviors and what different animals and birds are dropping in and stuff has just like been really exciting for me during lockdown, actually, because I've just had the sort of time to just observe that I haven't before. And I know I'm supposed to be like the bird expert or whatever, but I feel like I'm learning new things every day about like all the birds and animals and stuff, and it's just, yeah, it's really exciting.
I've had the same thing just in my garden. I saw a lizard this summer, which we've never had in our garden before.
Amazing.
Yeah, and then my little boy found that it shed its tail, or a different lizard had shed its tail on the grass, and it was the most exciting thing ever. And it's somehow more exciting when it's close to home, isn't it? That you realise how close we're all living to these amazing creatures. Mm. So if you were going to advise somebody who had a bit of woodland, for example, or a garden, you've mentioned putting out feeders and putting out making a pond perhaps, or are there any other things that kind of woodland owners or forest school practitioners could do to encourage more wildlife or more birds to visit?
Yeah, always. I mean, I think like the most important thing when it comes to encouraging wildlife into a green space is really like not focusing on the individual things like the bird feeders or whatever, but really looking at the big picture of like, why is it wildlife friendly? Why would animals want to come and spend their time here? And just really thinking about everything in combination, like, I don't know, are we letting the hedge go a little bit wild rather than keeping it really trimmed and pruned? Is the bug hotel in a place where like the bugs would feel comfortable creeping and crawling inside? You know, as well as putting bird feeders up, there are other things in the area that birds would want to feed on, you know, and just making it a really wildlife friendly space in general. And that's how you start, because I think it's really important that we do start recuperating our green spaces so that they're not just green, but that they're somewhere that wildlife can live. And I think that that's the really important first step towards that.
What was that name of that book, Lewis, that we read the other day that was all about that?
Oh. Feral.
Yes. That is George Monbiot's book.
No, it's very high on my list, and it has been for quite a long time. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, he talks a lot in that book about spaces that, especially in the UK, we think of as, you know, green and amazing natural spaces, and then he goes and visits them and he's like, this is a desert of wildlife. Yes, there's a lot of grass, but that's literally it, because it's been cropped by sheep, and it's not, as you just described, wildlife friendly in any way. It's very pleasing to our eye in terms of beautiful rolling hills and everything looking very neat, as you say, but once you get there, you're like, there's actually nothing here, this is a desert. And that's very true, that it seems like sort of local councils and town planners as well as individuals have kind of gone for that, like, oh, it's just untidy, isn't it? You know, even in our village, we've had a bit of a to and fro about the churchyard, because I suggested that the grass be left long for longer. And I said, you know, there are a lot of wildflower species there. Do you, you know, could we keep some of it long? And oh my goodness, it was like I had suggested something, you know, let's burn it to the ground or spray it purple. People really kind of, it looks awful. It looks really like nobody cares. It's like, no, it's the opposite. We really care about That, you know,
it kind of leads on to, doesn't it? We had so one of our listeners came in with a question for you and Maya, and kind of was wondering, how do we balance the needs of like conservation and sort of the wider effort of encouraging wildlife, and balancing that with a well-functioning economy and that need for people to earn. And I know in other podcasts and other interviews you've talked a lot about ecotourism and how that could be one of the big things. Is that something you still think could be the way forwards, or?
Yeah, definitely. Although, to be honest, I don't think there's that much ecotourism going on in the UK. Obviously, our landscapes are very popular and very commercialized, and I think a lot of people have this very strong idea of what like this the beautiful typical English landscape is. But I think in general, I think it's really important that we start placing environmentalism and conservation equally with like industrialization and consumerism and things like that, because the thing is, the only reason that the economy and things like that suffer when we put money towards the environment and looking after our planet and our wildlife is because we live in a system that's been structured to be extremely unhelpful to causes like that. And I think actually it's not about figuring out how to balance the two, but figuring out how to make sure that all the things that we're doing already in terms of money and government and all that kind of thing, and making sure that it's, you know, that it's our core value, I suppose, it's something that's a real priority to the country, because as soon as it is, things magically start happening. And like you were saying before about like rewilding, I think that's something that's particularly important, just because the UK, England especially, is such like a barren country, but also just looking after the remnants of nature rich places that we still have. The HS2 project is going ahead at the moment, and we have all the protests with that, and it's just, you know, like I think it's the perfect example in that it's not necessary for them to have to go and chop down all these really important ancient woodlands. And it's only because industrialization and the economy is given a priority over things like that. And I think, sorry, this is a very long way of saying, I think our priorities need to shift in terms of what we put our money towards and what we think is worth putting our money towards.
Yeah, and there's a lot of I know there's a lot of local coppice groups in the West Country, and a couple of them I've seen have had the motto of a woodland that pays is a woodland that stays. And I think that is one of the things that although doing things like nationalizing large areas of nature reserves and forestry and stuff, they do then protect them in one way, but it also means that people they're not seeing them as like financially beneficial. And if somebody's only got a mind looking at financial cost benefits, then they're going to go, well, you know, this was bought by National Trust X many years ago, and, you know, they make something on it, but not a lot. And, you know, a road is probably better in terms of those things. But if you could put in all that stuff of, you know, bird watching courses and all the leisure activities and forest bathing and all those things, then you start to see a woodland that is, it's almost, you don't want to say earning its keep, because it doesn't need to earn it to exist, but for someone looking at the numbers on a piece of paper, it makes more sense.
Makes it more palatable for that. Yeah, it's like that billboard I saw outside Taunton that said, you know, new, I think it was like new industrial estate or commercial buildings arriving here soon, unlocking the potential of the land. It's like, what? Like, what a hideous sentence that is the only way land can have any value is
for it to pour concrete on it.
Yeah, yeah.
Maya, I was going to say, do you find sometimes you're torn between, so I think we've kind of naturally moved into talking a bit about your activism and your conservation work and things. Do you find it difficult to balance your time between, you know, activism and talking to people and getting messages out there and birding, which is, as far as I understand it, sometimes it's a bit hit and miss. You go out, you might see something, you might not. You know, they're both very draining in terms of time resources? Is that something that pulls on you?
Yeah, always. Like, as with anyone who has more than one commitment in their life, I suppose. I do definitely think in a lot of ways lockdown's been really nice to be able to create more of an equilibrium with my timetable, I suppose, especially because I don't go to school anymore. But I think at the end of the day, because I've been doing activism and stuff since I was about 13 or 14, I think like the lesson that I've had to learn and that everyone should learn is that, like, you know, your time is valuable and you're allowed to say no to people sometimes, to take time for yourself and to go and do the things that you enjoy, including birding. Yeah, and I think that's been like a really important lesson. But yeah, I mean, birding's really important to me, so
Have you ever Have you ever been standing at the podium delivering a speech and then gone, oh my god, over there with the bird?
Tragically, most things, even about nature, are indoors in the middle of the city. That would be lovely to be at like a conference or something in the middle of a field.
Well, maybe that would be the way forward in the weird situation. You know, if you want a big gathering of people, then it has to be outside, and that would be better for everyone.
Yeah, definitely.
How would you, as a young person, you've been involved with Extinction Rebellion, is that right? And been on some of their
Yeah, not like really intensely, but I've been to a lot of their like meetings and events and stuff.
Mm-hmm. What's that like if you're kind of starting out and you're beginning to do that as a young person? Have you gone with family or with friends or by yourself? How did you kind of get into that and take the first step?
I think it was really easy for me just because one of my best mates was also really enthusiastic about getting involved. Back in the East, last Easter when they were in London, we both went down as soon as we could and we didn't end up being able to spend that much time there, but even just like being at the event was amazing because there was just like this positive energy where it really felt like we were creating change for the better. And then me and the same friend, we camped in Bristol last summer. And that was really exciting too. And my family's like really into them as well. My parents and I started a local group around where we live because there wasn't one. And yeah, I just think stuff like that can seem very scary from the outside, but a lot of the time it is, and everyone we talk to and stuff's always really friendly and really welcoming and really happy that there's someone else new that's joining. And yeah, I think that's really important for the movement in general to just constantly be very welcoming of everyone.
Yeah, the first interaction I had with Extinction Rebellion was some people sitting in a boat on a high street in Cornwall giving out cake. It's like, do you want some vegan cake? I was like, yes, I do. Of course I do. And they're like, yeah, now that you're eating cake, let me ask you some questions. It's like, sure, you've got my attention with the cake. Anytime.
Support the podcast today by becoming a Patreon member at childrenoftheforest.com. Check out the podcast links for more details.
There seems to be a kind of new generation of young people who are really kind of standing up and making their voices heard, which is very interesting to watch because I don't remember when I was your age that happening, really. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Somebody will probably pull me up on it. But have you got any ideas about why that might be, or and also how it feels to be part of that kind of wave of young people, and whether you feel like your voice is heard or whether you are feeling frustrated? So that's about three questions in one, really.
Yeah, I mean, it is a bit of a mystery, I suppose, but I've got a few hypotheses. I think the first one really is just the urgency of the issue, where we all, it's a climate change particularly, but a lot of environmental issues in general are very intangible and it's quite difficult for us to like properly comprehend, you know. But I think all these sort of distant estimated years of when the world's going to end or whatever are getting closer and closer, and it's no longer like, oh, when I'm 70 I guess climate change is going to take over. It's like, oh, when I'm 40. I guess like England's going to be underwater, you know, like it feels suddenly very urgent to kids my age, or not kids, young adults my age. And I think also the internet has been so massively helpful in mobilizing massive numbers of kids my age, you know, and really spreading information about the issue, where before we were relying on like schools, basically. Maybe, I don't know, the occasional like zine or something. But now, like, I don't even remember what I learned about climate change in school, but I'm constantly talking about it with people online. And I think that's made a massive difference. And I think the combination of the two has equaled a whole new generation of kids who are willing to go out on the streets to try and create change. And it's amazing because, like I said, I feel like I've been doing this for yonks, but it's been like 5 years. And even in that period of time, it's been so amazing to like suddenly see this wave of young people going out and trying to change the world, I guess, because it is a big difference to how it was even a few years ago. Yeah, it's really exciting, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing to watch from the outside as well, and very inspiring, especially to see so many young women doing that as well. And, you know, just going, I'm going to speak up. And it's very, very inspiring. Some of your other sort of political and activist work is about reaching out to Black and minority ethnic communities and investigating maybe why their access to nature is not as equal as those from a white background. And you set up a charity, is that right? Black to Nature?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that something that's still in your life? Are you still working on that at the moment?
Yeah, massively. So I've been running Black to Nature since 2016, and I've been doing nature camps, getting like VME or visually minority ethnic kids from inner city Bristol and taking them out to the countryside for a weekend. I've been doing that since 2015, and I think we've done about 9 of them now. And yeah, I guess I call myself like an intersectional activist, just because more and more I'm discovering that all the issues are interlinked. So it's not like my grassroots project where I'm working with kids is completely separate from, say, my climate change activism. So like, for example, the fact that VME communities are already being disproportionately affected by the effects of climate change and other environmental issues like pollution and stuff like that. And I think, but there's also something that's massively important for the well-being of the people we're working with and of the communities that we're trying to help, I suppose, because I can't... Oh, it was Richard Pankhurst who was saying how... Sorry, there's someone right out the right side of the window. I'll do that sentence again. Yeah, I think it was Richard Pankhurst who said that he believes that having access to nature is a human right. And I really believe that in the UK, more and more access to nature is becoming a privilege. And that you can only do if, like, I don't know, you're middle class and you have enough time and you have enough money. And I'm really trying to fight against that because I think it's so important that everyone has that opportunity. Yeah,
absolutely. I was reading, I think you shared on Twitter, actually, the Improving Access to Green Space 2020 review, and the fact that that acknowledges so much inequality in access to nature and also really forefronts the importance of it. And, you know, it's very honest and very broad about the benefits to people in every aspect of life, really, in terms of, you know, even it was saying about life expectancy. And you look at how the gap is increasing between rich and poor, minority ethnic communities and white communities, and in terms of housing, in terms of life expectancy, in terms of access to the outside. And as you say, it's all so interconnected. I was actually quite surprised by how sort of forthright the report was in terms of how important the access to nature was. Yet I saw such a disconnect with what seems to be happening in our current government. And I sort of wonder how these things happen, you know, is the people that are writing that report, do they not speak to anybody who actually gets to make any sort of decision? Yeah, it's very interesting. It is an interesting read if anybody is interested.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Do you think that sits in any way in counter to what we were talking about earlier with ecotourism and putting these things in place that, you know, provide stable economies for rural, you know, communities? And then we balance that against saying that we don't think the access to nature should be a pay-to-play privilege. You know, how do we balance those things of encouraging people to give up land that is profitable them in one way, and to say, you know, you need to make potentially less money in this other way?
I mean, I don't think those two necessarily have to be at odds with each other. In the, I don't necessarily, like, you know, having access to a green space and having access to nature isn't necessarily going to, like, the local English heritage park and, like, wandering around in the grass and the fields and stuff. It can be as simple as going to the local park and playing, like, football on the grass or whatever. And I think, you know, as with everywhere else, like, I suppose you could almost say there's different tiers of green space where some people would maybe turn their nose up at the lower ones. That doesn't really matter because it's still a green space and it's still really important to some people because they don't have access in any other way. And I guess what I'm advocating for isn't for people to be spending loads of money each weekend going to, like, the local RSPB reserve, but just that they understand that it's really important that now and again they renew that connection to nature, and that they do in some shape or form have access to a green space. And I think actually there's a lot of work going on behind the scenes at the moment to do with increasing the amount of green space in urban areas, because it is actually quite a large issue in a lot of places, like in London.
And that's completely a kind of housing and town planning issue, isn't it? It's like another overlap there in terms of how housing is designed. And again, you see that issue of inequality there. If you're designing a new housing project, and the example that was in the news last year of housing projects having to cater for, you know, a certain percentage will be social housing, but then they were gating off the access to the green space that they had to provide, and weren't allowing the people who were living in the social housing to have access to that space and things like that. It's good that it makes the news and we hear about it, but it's not good that it's happening. And one of the things in that report is how housing that's near to a green space, even if it is a small park, is several thousand pounds more expensive than housing that isn't. So as long as that kind of exists, and, you know, as you say, it doesn't have to be, an amazing nature reserve, as long as it's equal and fair.
Yeah, and I guess that also links up to what I was saying before about, like, access to nature being perceived as a privilege when it really shouldn't be. And I think a lot of people also, like the ones who go into green spaces, have a very certain expectation of the other kinds of people that are going to be out there with them, and they sort of want it to remain like an oasis of privilege for them to, like, stay in, rather than having, like, everyone else flood into it too. And it's, you know, that's not how it's supposed to work, basically.
What's coming up on the horizon for you over the next few weeks and months? I know it's a bit of a weird one because obviously things that we might have planned may all be cancelled, but what are you up to, and what can we look out for in things you're involved with?
Well, all sorts of things, really. But it's all very bitty because, I finished doing my A-levels back in March, and I'm getting my results next week. So that will be exciting.
Good luck.
Thank you. I need it. Sorry, I'm trying to think of some things that aren't like secret.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry, that's so mysterious.
Yeah, tell us
a secret. Yeah, I think mainly I'm just carrying on with the stuff that I'm doing at the moment. Like, I'm constantly trying to push forward Black to Nature. Like, I'm going off to uni in the autumn of 2021, and I really want to make sure that Black to Nature can continue without me and won't just sort of crumble apart as soon as I'm not here to constantly maintain it. Mm-hmm. And I guess just constantly pushing forward with my activism, my campaigning, and trying to change things.
Yeah. Mm. Amazing. Oh, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Lewis, have you got anything you want to ask?
No, that's been great. Where are the good places that people can, if people want to find out about your work or follow the sort of activism you're doing, where can people follow you?
People can follow me on Twitter at BirdGirlUK, where I'm tweeting about all the different stuff I do. Or you can follow my blog, which is just called Bird Girl, where I've got a lot of information about my travels and Black to Nature and my campaigning.
Amazing.
Brilliant.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me on today. This has been really interesting. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Cheers. Bye.
If you like this podcast and want to support more episodes, you can donate through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/children of the forest to show your support for the Forest School podcast.